Sorry for saying sorry media presents the Purr Podcast, the best podcast for feline medicine and surgery with tips, tricks, and updates for the entire veterinary healthcare team. If you're dying to know more about cats, keep on listening. Here are your hosts, Dr. Susan Little, famous cat vet and textbook author, and Dr. Yola Kerpenstein, talented surgeon and social media geek.
Hello, this is Dr. Yola Kerpenstein.
Okay, so this is Dr. Susan Little, who did not hear Yola say 3, 2, 1, which he normally says.
And he did, but you interrupted me.
When?
When you said, do you know the author of this paper? I was at 3, 2, and then I wanted to say 1, and then you asked that question.
I didn't hear you. I'm sorry for interrupting.
Right. So okay. This is the Purr Podcast, and my name is Dr. Yola Kerpenstein, as I said before, and we have the amazing Dr. Susan Little, who kind of mocked off of, what was the word that you used?
Flubbed.
The intro. So this will mean that she will have to do the extra, and hopefully she will do that this time the right way. So, Dr. Susan,
yes,
this is the second of two sessions where we are discussing papers
that
talk about cats.
Yes,
and both of our papers are from the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery, which once again is one of our favorite journals because it's open access. At least part of it is now completely open access, or is still
Yes, it's now completely open access. Yeah. So we love it for that. We love it because it's feline only. And we love it because it's from the AAFP and the NISFM, the two organizations that champion feline medicine.
So very exciting, and it has wonderful articles. And this is one of those articles. This is a review article of Dr. Daniel Lau and Dr. John Williams. It's called The Surgical Management of Feline Biliary Tract Disease, Decision-Making and Techniques. And I know John really well. He is a good friend of mine. He is a seasoned surgeon. And so I'm very excited to dive into this article.
So let me get it up on the screen. So because it's a, an open access article, we can certainly show it to you. And I will put a link to it in the show notes. And I'll also put a link where you can find the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery, because you might be thinking, oh, that's great, it's open access, but like, how do I get to it? So I'll put that link in as well. And I'll also point out that if you're a member of either AAFP or ISFM, you can access it through your membership as well. So, but anybody can access it. So I'll put the link to the journal itself in the show notes.
And if you're a member of the Patreon account, you can see it. You can see Dr. Susan. You can see me. You can see the article. What else do you want?
I don't know. What else is there?
Right.
Yeah. So okay. I wanted to talk about this article because you rarely hear people talk about biliary tract disease in cats, right?
Right.
And there's a strong component of surgical management. So why don't we hear much about biliary tract disease, do you think?
I bet because it is pretty uncommon. And if it happens, people send it immediately through. So if a cat gets biliary disease or hepatic disease, often they're sent to specialist clinics. So I think those are probably the two main reasons why we don't see them that often. But even in a specialty clinic that I was working at, which was a university tertiary clinic, we didn't see them that often.
You know, I do wonder, though, if this might be one of the conditions in feline medicine that we think doesn't happen very often because we're not looking for it, or it's not easy to diagnose. Because there's certainly lots of things in feline medicine like that, right? Like short of a biliary duct obstruction, because you're more likely to have clinical signs with that, or more obvious clinical signs, right? But if you don't have obstruction, your clinical signs. Well, Eve, that's what this article actually mentions, right? That the clinical signs are nonspecific. So, right. Yeah,
but
so that's why I wonder if it doesn't.
Signs in cats nonspecific. You always talk about the four clinical signs that every cat has.
Yeah.
And it's
typical. What are they, Yola?
Anorexia.
Yeah.
Not doing right.
Lethargy.
Lethargy.
Yeah.
Vomiting.
Yep.
And then I want to say diarrhea, but that might
be. Yeah, the fourth one can either be diarrhea or decreased appetite.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's anorexia. I already said that.
Okay.
Or hyporexia.
Hyporexia, or,
Hyporexia.
Yeah, so, and that's true of so many feline diseases. And this article points out that it's true of biliary tract disease, too. So I think sometimes we miss the diagnosis.
Yeah, and I would say also that I think that there are probably more medical diagnoses than surgical diagnoses for cats with liver or biliary disease. So, it's not... That's probably why I might say that I didn't see that many of them. I've had my share, especially when I read through what the surgery indications are, including bioperitonitis, severe cholestasis, focal neoplasia, disease that's refractory to medical management, whatever that is. Yes, I have had those, but it's not, I think it's way more common in the D word than in cats itself. So, but I think let's go through this cat adventure through the biliary tree and see what we come up with.
As we move on, I just want to ask you, because one of the highlighted areas here says differentiating surgery from medical cases isn't always straightforward.
Right.
And yet when they talk about surgical indications, these are pretty, I would think they're, these are going to be pretty sick cats, aren't they? With like bioperitonitis.
Right.
But I guess it's going to take some pretty good imaging, if nothing else, to.
I think it's mainly meant because often the obstruction of the bile duct is secondary. So it's not primary.
Okay.
So especially with cats with severe thyroiditis, there's lots of things that happen in the cats that can cause this. And then, yes, these cats are sick. I mean, they're not like the D word that comes in that is completely yellow and still wagging its tail. Most of the time it's multiple diseases that affect these cats. It's rarely just a biliary problem.
That's a good point. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And they have kind of the obligatory graphic showing the anatomy of the hepatobiliary system.
Right.
Right. And if I remember correctly, I believe they're showing it here, like this pancreatic duct and the major duodenal papilla have a common entrance. Is that right?
Yeah, so there's a difference between the D word and the cat. And, I am trying to remember which one it is, which doesn't really show my
I think it's the cat where those two, where bile duct, common bile duct and pancreatic duct either enter into the duodenum together or they actually merge and then enter the duodenum as one duct. I think it's the cat that does that because that's, I think, what this graphic is showing us. Yeah, look at this. It says the cat has a fused common bile duct and pancreatic duct. So there.
That's correct. But I also think that the duct, the main duct, is not the same in the cat
as
in the D. So I think in the cat, if I remember well, but I need to look it up, is that the accessory pancreatic duct is bigger than the pancreatic duct itself. I think there was some difference between the D and the cat there. So, but like I said, it's somewhere in the back of my mind. I probably should have read the article a little closer than that. But I don't think they talk about this. So while you will be chatting about the next topic, I'll look it up real quick and see if that's really true, because I have Sletter here.
Okay, you can have a look. I think it's probably true for a lot of us that there's a little voice in your head that says the anatomy is different between cat and dog, but you can't remember exactly what it is.
Right, exactly.
So you shouldn't feel bad. So
no, but I should know this. But you know.
Well, so as Yola's looking up the anatomy of the hepatobiliary system in the lesser species, we'll move on a little bit. Review articles like this I love, and especially this one, because it's very complete, and also it's got lots of really good photos, right? There's things that you just can't describe well without a photo. So this is a really well done article with some very pertinent photos. And they also point out at several spots in this review article where cats are different from the other species. Like, so for example, they point out that you rarely see mucoceles in the gallbladder of cats compared to our friends that begin with D. So they do kind of take a little overview of biliary tract disease with a couple of great photos. So this first figure they have there is pretty impressive. Like, that's a common bile duct that we can see in that first photo. And it's just massively enlarged. I don't think I've ever seen a common bile duct like that big. So this is a result of extrahepatic biliary obstruction. So the obstruction has happened outside the boundaries of the liver. So I think that's pretty impressive there. And the next couple of photos are from the same patient, right? So it turns out that the cat had a coccolith. So it had a gallstone essentially that was trapped in the common bile duct. So the picture just on the left there is showing you with the black arrow, you can see through the common bile duct, through the wall, you can actually just faintly see that there's a stone there. And then they show you the stone after it was removed. That's, I guess, a good outcome. That's one of the outcomes that might have the best prognosis, where it's something like this. Although Yola points out that a lot of these cats do have other diseases. Yola, if you go in and take that stone out, as they did in this case, what happens to the common bile duct? Do you think it will eventually kind of decrease in size, or does it matter? Maybe it doesn't matter if it decreases.
It probably doesn't. I mean, the issue with these is that you can get stricture formation in the common bile duct when you do surgery.
Right.
But so we try to flush them out or take them out in a different way without cutting into the bile duct, which is called a colodocotomy. But if you don't, most of them, they're so big that you can suture them back together and then they will regress in time. I mean, okay. They are enlarged because of the pressure. And so I also have the answer. So this
okay.
is...
Okay, what's the answer?
So I knew there was some difference. The canine bile duct terminates in the duodenum near the opening of the minor pancreatic. This combined opening of the minor or accessory pancreatic duct and the bile duct is the major duodenal papilla. The feline bile duct usually joins the major pancreatic duct before entering the duodenum.
Yeah.
The cats with intestinal hepatitis, blah, 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 blah. So that was the difference. So I knew there was a difference between the two. And now we know what it was.
Yep. Excellent. And I just went back to that graphic because it does show you where the major duodenal and the minor duodenal papilla are, just to give you an idea of the geography of what happens in the D species versus cats. So
right,
very interesting. Okay, so we went through our little obstruction there, And, I mentioned this just a bit ago that I think for a lot of these cases, good imaging is really, really important, right? Especially if you're looking for something like a gallstone that might be causing extra hepatic obstruction that could potentially be removed.
Right.
So I'm presuming these are, it says mineral density cololiths. So if you remove the gallstone yellow, like that cat, other cat we just looked at, is the cat at risk of forming more gallstones?
It could, yeah. So there's lots of discussion about if you should give a medication or not to prevent.
Right. Like a choluretic to thin the.
Right.
Yes. Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay.
And then the pictures show gallbladder stones that you can see, but there are also gallbladder stones that you cannot see on the radiograph. We hardly ever took radiographs. We normally always took ultrasound.
Yeah.
Which is sometimes difficult because there's air in the bowel. And if you have an obstruction that's close to the bowel, sometimes it's really difficult to see. You just see enlarged bile ducts. Mm-hmm.
I think most of these cats are going to get radiographed anyway, right? Because their presenting clinical signs are non-specific. And so it's pretty logical that a lot of these cats are going to get x-rayed.
But the issue is a bit that you see gallbladder stones either in the canine or in the feline doesn't mean that they have clinical signs associated. Hmm. As a matter of fact, most of the gallbladder stones are without any clinical signs, as long as they don't really obstruct. So when they're in the gallbladder, they can sit there for a long time and not give any clinical signs. While if they are, of course, obstructing, then you get all the clinical signs associated with it.
The stones themselves must not be that common, because if I think, over my career and how many cats we've imaged, I can only remember a handful of cats where we found stones either on ultrasound or radiographs. And I know we found them kind of incidentally where they weren't the cause of the problem, but gosh, they can't be all that common. So you mentioned ultrasound. So these are ultrasound, some nice ultrasound images. The one on the left, the white arrows are pointing to the tortuous hyperechoic biliary tract, right? So that's a finding that I've seen several times, for sure, having this tortuous this tortuous appearance. So they say this was observed throughout the liver in a 16-year-old male neutered cat with advanced renal failure. So that says these findings are representative of extensive cholelithiasis.
Yes, cholelithiasis.
I find that a hard word.
So
yeah,
cholecodo means it's in the bile duct, and
okay.
Cholelithiasis is a gallbladder stone. So, just going back to the difference between these and cats, in the D, it's very common to have what we call gallbladder mucoceles, which is this abnormal chronic inflammation of the gallbladder wall, which we don't see in cats at all. So that's something, most of the time it's cholestasis, what we see in the cat, and cholestasis can be caused by a lot of things. And it's very rarely caused by gallbladder stones, I would say that's more the zebra than anything else. So I would say that, it's much more common to get gallbladder duct obstruction because of secondary processes like inflammation, fibrosis, or something else than it is from cholelithiasis itself.
Yeah. And that the article does point out that gallbladder mucoceles are rare in cats. So,
right.
Yeah. So let's move on. And so they do have a nice section kind of discussing trying to make decisions when you've got biliary tract disease, right? When you see these tortuous biliary ducts, or you see a cololith, as we saw in that first patient. And so how do you know if they need surgery or not? And so one of the quotes that's pulled out of the body of this article says that extrahepatic obstruction is not an immediate indication for surgery. So you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I suspect it's not necessarily always clear if these cats need surgery, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's why you need to have really, really good workup. But sometimes it's really difficult. So if you have a local pancreatitis that causes this obstruction, imagine how difficult it is to find that when you're not a experienced ultrasonographer, or you know, all the medical science say you have an obstruction of the biliary tree, but you don't really know why, because you can't find an obvious stone. So what can it be? It could be a tumor, it could be local inflammation, could be, you know, contracture because of earlier disease. So that is why it's so difficult in these cases to make that decision. So if you find obvious stones, then it's easy, but very rarely you find a cause to say, okay, now we have to take him to surgery. I would say the only cause that I can think of is if he has a bile peritonitis, where, you know, there's leakage from bile into the abdomen. And I think in cats, if I'm correct, the bile is often has a bacterial component. Well, in the D word, it might not. So there's a huge difference in the D. If you get a bile peritonitis in the canine that is sterile, these animals can live for a really long time without any clinical stuff. Yeah, they get an enlarged belly, but they're still fine. Wow. As soon as there is a bacterial component, these D's go down the drain very, very quickly. So if you have a dog walking into your clinic with a huge bile peritonitis because he has a ruptured gallbladder, and he's wagging his tail and being pretty happy, and this slow process, most of the time there's no bacteria involved. Well, if you have this dog that's crashing, he has a bacterial peritonitis combined with bile peritonitis. That's not a good sign. So you have to be much faster with these. In cats, it is so rare to see a rupture of the bile tract. And so most of the time, and because if I remember well, cats have a higher bacterial chance of bacterial overgrowth, probably that's for me a reason to do surgery quite quickly to find out.
Isn't the bile itself irritating though?
It is. Yeah, you have a peritonitis.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, and there's a lot of fluid formation, but
yeah,
you know, it's always, it amazes me how these are canines come into the clinic feeling pretty happy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but if you have, you know, like I said, open surgery can have two purposes. First, you know what it is, and you have to deal with it, like a bile peritonitis, ruptured gallbladder, or something else. Or it can have a diagnostic function where you just want to find out, open it up, and see what's going on. And that is what we call exploratory laparotomy, which is, for me, a very, if you don't know what's going on and all these signs point out that there's something wrong with the biliary tree, that's one of the reasons why you could open them up. It's a different communication, of course, to the owner, but sometimes we let the evil spirits out by just opening up the kennel.
Yeah, but it's a good point, right? It's valid. There are times when it's valid to use exploratory laparotomy as a diagnostic tool, and the times when you might do that can vary. You might be a practitioner in like a small town and you don't have easy access to, let's say, advanced imaging or an internist, right? That may be perfectly valid for you in some patients to do an exploratory laparotomy. So the article, so one thing I found interesting is that it says extrahepatic biliary obstruction even when it's complete, is not an immediate indication for surgery. And they kind of refine that up here. And then they say, unless it's severe and complete, or the patient's refractory to medical management. So right. I guess in a lot of patients, they probably have gone a medical management route first.
Yeah, yeah. And that it probably has to do also with the fact that, you know, you don't have to, you can have gallbladder stones in the bile ducts without being completely obstructive. It's just like you can have a foreign body in the bowel that is not completely obstructive. So still food can pass. And those animals often are a lot less sick than the ones that have a complete obstruction. So yeah, if you have a complete obstruction and the bowel cannot go anywhere, these animals will turn yellow and go down the drain. So obviously you have to do something. But if you have a relatively normal animal with elevated bile acids but and an obvious obstruction, not complete obstruction, I would try medical management before anything else. It's pretty invasive to do surgery on these cases. Especially because they're often critical. And so if you have medical ways of treating them by, for instance, making the bowel thinner, I would definitely try that.
So there is quite a nice review of what medical management might be. And I love that the first thing they mentioned was analgesia. Like these cats, we have to assume that they are experiencing pain.
Right.
Yeah. So I like that they put that number one. And they talk a little bit about what types of drugs. And generally, it's going to be opioids, because in a sick patient who's probably not eating and might be dehydrated and probably has more than one disease going on, you don't want to use non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Right. But you could use different types of nerve blocks or ketamine infusions and so on. So they talk a little bit about that. And then fluid therapy, of course, right? But then here's probably to your point, Yola, they are talking about using antibiotics.
Right.
Right. And I guess that, you know, goes back to what you said, that cats may be more likely to have a significant bacterial population in the bile. So that might be what's driving this.
Yeah, although they do say that, you know, if there's no clinical signs of an active infection, you know, don't use prophylactic antibiotics. I probably am of the opinion that I always want to have a culture first before I start antibiotics. So if it has a bowel peritonitis, I just stick a needle in it and culture it before I start it. If I have a gallbladder that's completely abnormal, I probably will aspirate the gallbladder and get some fluid out, so I know at least what bacteria I treat, and I get a culture and sensitivity. And then, yes, so the use of prophylactic antibiotics, it depends on how sick the case is. If you get a cat that's crashing, I will put antibiotics in there anyway. So, you know, it's just as a precaution before I do a major surgery, because these surgeries can be really long. So if you have a surgery longer than an hour, that cat will need to get antibiotics because the infection rate increases with every hour that you do surgery. So I'm a little bit more aggressive. The other thing is, this is a European article, and in Europe, the antibiotic rules are a little more stringent than in the US. So there is a possibility that this is more the European view but if there's any inclination that there might be an infection, I'll probably put them on therapeutic antibiotics, which means you start before the surgery, before the incision with injectables, and then you.
And that's what they say here. You know, start 30 minutes prior, before incision, and they recommend some drugs.
Right. But I do try to take a culture and sensitivity before.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So they do talk about referral for surgery.
Right.
Right. Which, if we're lucky enough to have a surgeon in the area and an owner who is able to take the cat, But, you know, even like you said, Yola, like you worked in a tertiary care facility in more than one, right? Because you've been right. you've been in working in universities in the U.S. and as well as in the Netherlands. Right. And we still you still didn't see a lot of these cats coming in for hepatobiliary surgery.
No, and these are tough surgeries. So right. if you think about what could go wrong, there's a lot of indications that you can find. So if you do surgery for, you know, do an exploratory and make a decision with the owner if they want to go on or not, I can understand that. But most of the therapeutic surgeries that you will do involve either redirecting the bile flow, cutting into these really small bile ducts, or doing rescue surgery of pancreas and duodenum. Those are really complicated surgeries, and they're listed here. Yeah, I mean, they talk about putting a tube in, that's relatively easy, but most of these surgeries are not easy and are definitely, if you don't do them more often. So if you look at, I was a soft tissue surgery expert and I can count the cats on one hand that I got per year. That means that you don't have a lot of experience. If you do this once in your lifetime, it's not a case I would put on the surgery table, except when there's no other option.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, the fact that they're the cases that do get to tertiary care are uncommon, so it's really hard for anybody. Although I guess some of your surgical techniques from the lesser species you can also use in cats. So right. you know, maybe you get
it's just a lot smaller.
Way.
You have to realize that
True.
Anything in the D is a lot bigger.
True.
So we're used to a big gallbladder and big bile ducts. This is all a lot smaller. So with these cases, I always use loops. So because you know I need magnification to see things, and they do a nice overview. But you know there is sometimes it's limited. What I think that the main thing is if you do anything with a cat surgery wise is to think about nutrition afterwards. So, you know, how are you going to support this cat? Because these cats often have not only biliary disease, but often have liver disease. They might have pancreatic disease. And so you need to, if you want to do something, you need to think about the beginning and the end, which means that you have to look at the whole cat and how are you going to support it. So if you do surgery, good pain management, put a tube in, you know, there's a lot of things that I would demand before I would take a cat like this into surgery. So a E-tube is the least that I would ask for.
Just before we scroll down to the surgery part, I just wanted to linger on this quote that they pulled out because it's something I know you've said many times. It's something I say many times for any exploratory surgery or any abdominal surgery, right? So they're saying, look at the whole abdomen. Like even if you think you're going in to look for a stone in the an extrahepatic stone, look at the whole abdomen, right? So, and
yeah,
another
my
way.
Soapbox. You knew it was my soapbox.
It's mine too. I often say, don't leave empty-handed. You know, right. like the situations where you really don't know what is going on. So you do an exploratory laparotomy, and like you look at things, you go, oh, I don't see anything. Well, that's not good enough. Don't leave empty-handed, right?
No, and I think we don't. You know, a lot of people don't have a set way of how they look, how they do an exploratory. And so they often forget things.
Good point.
That's, you know, when it's worth to open the cat, it's worth to look around. So I hate people that make a very small incision, say they did an exploratory laparotomy. Just, you know, the time that it saves by closing the abdomen, it makes it so much more difficult to see everything. So just, I mean, I hate to say it, whack them open as much as you have, do a good exploratory and then deal with the issue. Don't just go in and you know, just look at the one thing that you think is wrong and then let the rest go. So for me, it's a really important thing. And I've done many, many, many re-explorations because people left things in behind or didn't find something. And then you get to that sort sort of situation. So we're almost at time, so we need to finish this up.
I just want to follow up on just one thing you said, because I think it's important. So you said something about forgetting things. So do you do your exploratory, like your abdominal examination, do you do it in a certain order? Is it worth having an order?
Always. Yeah.
Okay.
So I start at one point and always the same.
Okay.
And that's why I never forget to look at the adrenal glands.
Okay. I like that. I like that, to have an order. That's something that you could even put that on the whatever form you use as a surgical record, for example. Like, you could just make sure that that's part of it to remind you of the order that you're going to go through. So, yeah. So just in wrapping up.
You can also use your nurses for that. So that your nurse says, did you check this? Did you check that? Have some help with that. But I think that that's really important, because otherwise you'll miss things. The one thing I remember early in my career was a elderly dog. It was an Irish setter that had, and I'm saying the D word, but an Irish setter that had a GDV. And as you know, it's a very common breed. It's a deep chested breed, but normally we see them in young dogs. So I was like, you know, and this dog was 12, it was really old. And I was like, this is so weird to get a GDV. And if I would not have done a thorough exploratory, I wouldn't have found that the dog also had a obstruction in his jejunum. And so this is why he had a torsion. So, you know, you can just fix the GDV and then close them up and say, oh, I'm done in 20 minutes. But just by doing that, you will prevent that you have to go back in and then fix the real problem.
A really good story. Yeah, really good story. Yeah, especially if something doesn't seem right to you, right? You need to trust your gut instinct. Right. I just wanted to ask you this as we're wrapping up. They do just this little section on minimally invasive surgery. And I know you're like a laparoscopy fan, but I would think that you're still going to be somewhat limited in cats to do some of these surgeries through laparoscopy, because as you said, like, the structures are so small.
As a matter of fact, cats are ideal. Cats and ferrets are my favorite endoscopic animals. And the reason for it is they're like balloons.
Yeah.
You just blow them up and they become so big and you have so much space. Well, you would think it's such a small animal, but because of the flexibility of their abdomen, you can blow them up quite nicely without interfering with low pressures, but still you can see a lot. And then because you have a scope, you have a 3x magnification. So you see everything much better. So for me, at the end stage of my career, I stuck a scope in everything. So that's the first thing I do. I do an exploratory. First thing I do, I stuck a scope in it. Because the other thing, which is really nice, so say that you have a cat that has adenocarcinoma all over his abdomen. You know, that cat had a little hole. I took a biopsy. We did the cytology. It was so easy to do if you can do it through ultrasound, of course. But these people really wanted to have an exploratory. So that is really the advantage of minimal invasive. The big things you see very quickly, and the small things you can see very good because of magnification. I used to have a 20-minute limit. So I said, if I can't fix it in 20 minutes through endoscopy, I open up the cat. So that's what you have to do.
So they're talking about like biliary tree surgery, though.
Yeah. So the number one procedure done in people is removal of gallbladders through minimal invasive.
Right.
That's how it started.
Right.
So if you and gallbladder removal in a cat is super easy, minimally invasively. That's what I would do. Incising the biliary tree and removing stones. No, you're not going to do it. So minimal invasive, but you can do it by minimal of a visual assistance. So I had that camera and I could see everything so much better through the camera. So, you know, I still use minimal invasive techniques, but then mainly the magnification of the camera.
Yeah. And to your point, Yola, if surgery is warranted, a feeding tube should be considered. I would almost say it should be mandatory, right?
I mean, I think that's, you know, that's a lot of these cases came from internal medicine. And my request / demand was, if you want me to do surgery, you better have a tube in this guy.
Yeah. So lovely article that highlights the, I guess, the challenges and reviews what we do and do not know about biliary tract disease, hepatobiliary tract disease in cats. So we'll put a link to this article in the show notes and I'll put a link as well to where the Journal of Feline Medicine and Surgery is, because it is open access.
Right.
So, yeah.
This is awesome. Thank you, Dr. Susan.
Oh, I'm really glad we looked at this article, because it's an area, as you say, Yola, that not very many people have a lot of experience with it, but the article's really well done. So it's quite a nice review as well. There's a, you know, even if you're never going to be doing surgical management of biliary disease in cats, it's still a really good article to read.
Right.
Yep. Cool. Okay. So I guess I get the extro, right?
Yes, I get the exit.
Okay. Well, this has been the PRRR podcast, and we hope that you will check us out on social media at PRRR podcast. And I, again, am proud to say that our website is once again up to date, prrrpodcast.net, thanks to our one and only employee, Ben. Nice.
Our hero, Ben.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. So there we go.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Susan. Hey. Great episode.
See you next time.
Bye.
Dr. Susan Little is a feline medicine specialist with 2 cat-only hospitals in Ottawa, Canada. She is best known as an international speaker and as the author and editor of 2 textbooks, The Cat, Clinical Medicine and Management, and August, Consultations in Feline Internal Medicine. Along with 3 cats, she also admits to owning 2 dogs, and you can follow her on social media with the handle @CatPetSusan. Dr. Yola Kerpenstein is a diplomate of the American and European College of Veterinary Surgeons and a big cat fan. His specialties range from surgical oncology and reconstruction to minimally invasive surgery. He is the author of 2 textbooks on basic and reconstructive surgery. Did you know he was allergic to cats? Yola works currently at Hill's Pet Nutrition. You can follow him on social media with the handle @GVETSX. This episode is made possible by the generous sponsorship of the Take the Pledge Against Stool Bites in Pets Facebook page. Did you know there are 3 easy steps to treat bladder stones in cats with lower urinary tract signs? Step 1 is to take a radiograph, and if there is a stone present in the bladder, step 2 is to use the Minnesota Urolith app for iPhone and Android to determine the most likely type of stone. Step 3 is to treat the cat for at least 2 to 3 weeks with an appropriate diet and see if the stone gets smaller. If so, keep feeding that diet until the stone is completely gone on follow-up radiographs. If not, check compliance with the owner and look for alternative treatment options. Join veterinarians worldwide to take the pledge not to remove struvite stones by surgery anymore. The opinions of this podcast are those by Dr. Susan Little and Dr. Yola Kerpenstein. Veterinary medicine is a complex profession, and often there are multiple diagnostic and therapeutic options for different disease processes. If you're a pet owner with questions, please go to your local veterinarian. If you're a veterinary professional, ask your questions on our Instagram page @PRRR Podcast.